Hi everyone, it's Amanda here, and you are on International Yachting Radio. Today I've got the amazing Dr. Spike Briggs, who is the CEO and owner of Medical Support Offshore, who I proudly represent. And he's also the lead author of the Ship Captain's Medical Guide, which you should all have in your bookshelf. And he's done a whole bunch of really exciting things. He's also a consultant in ICU in the UK. So he's on the front line. He's working, keeping you all safe at sea, does a lot of research. But actually, Spike, you could introduce yourself.
How would you
introduce yourself?
Well, I don't know, really. I think you've done a better job than I would be able to do. So the MD of Medical Support Offshore, which keeps me quite busy, and I'm still a full-time intensive care consultant here in the UK. And I've just finished my week on call. Had a pretty hard week, really. I've got a few days off. So I've just been out mountain biking this morning just to keep my head clear and keep my body going. And I think that's I know people talk a lot about mental well-being and what have you, and it's a very kind of in topic, but I think there is a good deal of truth to it, and I think going out and getting exercise and looking after your body as well as your mind is a good way about things. So I feel better for that. Hopefully I won't fall asleep whilst we're talking.
No way. We'll have way too much fun. How did you get into marine medicine? How did that all start? Because you haven't always been a doctor.
No. So I started off, I've always been a sailor since 3 years old. I've been sailing dinghies. And then my first degree was in engineering. And I sailed for the university competitively in dinghies. As part of my degree, I was actually a sewage engineer out in Bahrain for a year on my industrial placement for my degree. So that taught me a lot about managing, people and what have you. And throughout that first time at university, I got into doing yacht deliveries, and this is the beginning of the 80s. So I did my first yacht delivery in 1980. And some long trips as well. So from Greece to Belgium, I think, was the longest one. And it's really learning sailing the hard way, because you're very short crewed and you're on a boat that you don't know. And, quite a lot of these boats don't have everything there. And at the beginning of the 80s as well, it was, there wasn't much kind of emphasis on safety. So I can say on a boat before, from all the yacht deliveries are dead, never wore a life jacket, never wore a harness. And also, when you're young, when you're 18, 19, 20 years old, you just think you're, kind of invincible and, nothing will ever happen to you. So I did that. Then I worked as an offshore engineer out in the States and all over the world, really, in my 20s, coming through the 1980s. And then I just thought I'd had a great time being an engineer. And I guess kind of underneath everything else, I still am an engineer. And I look back to think about what it taught me. I used to design foundations for oil rigs. That's what I did. And I don't think I could do that now. But what I do remember is it taught me a way of thinking about things, which actually is very, very useful in intensive care. Just getting down to basics and looking at the facts you actually know that aren't just somebody else's opinion about things. So it taught me a lot about logical thinking and what have you. I decided I was going to go do something else. So I decided I would go and do medicine. I think I'd earned too much in the offshore industry. So I had too much money in the bank account. So I thought I'd just go and do something else. In fact, I had a letter from my bank manager saying I had too much money in my bank account and I needed to move some. So I wish I'd. It's not really kind of happened since, really. I should have framed it, really. Anyway, so I went to medical school in Southampton. Came through medical school. I hooked up with intensive care at a very early stage at medical school. So I spent quite a lot of my time at medical school actually in intensive care, just getting involved with things, a few research projects and learning the practical side of things. Learning the practical side of things, but not the wisdom about it, actually. So knowing how to do stuff, but not really knowing why I was doing the stuff. So I did all that. And then the year in intensive care, as soon as I finished my... So when you finish as a doctor, when you qualify as a doctor, you do the first year, you do a house job. So I did that here in Southampton. And then I moved over to Portsmouth to do a year of intensive care. And then on the sailing side of things, I decided I'd go and do around the world yacht race. So I did the 96-97 version of the Global Challenge. So that's sailing around the world the wrong way. So so that's upwind all the way through the Southern Ocean, which is quite hard work, really. I was the navigator on the boat, primarily. I was a doctor on the boat as well, so I kind of looked after the medical side of things as well, but primarily as a navigator. And we did pretty well. We came second to Mike Golding, so we didn't do too badly. So I did that, and then I got involved with the challenge business. I think because I'd given them some advice during the race about how to do things, and so I worked for them for the next 9 years, actually. And that's what really taught me about marine medicine, because the Global Challenge was all about amateurs going around the world and all comers from the age of 18 to 65. So I had all kinds of people turning up to do, you know, one of the hardest yacht races in the world. And it was my job to train the medics, screen the people, look after the medical kits, and also to, you know, provide a telemedical support service as well. So it was pretty, you know, it was pretty busy. And then the challenge business sadly went bust in about 2005. But because I'd come into contact with so many people who in the sailing community who were then going on to do private yachting, they were always asking me to do things for them. So I thought, well, I'll, you know, form a company. So I formed MSOS, and that just kind of was working just from home, just on the kitchen table, and just getting a bit busier. And then in 2007, somebody asked me to write a book on marine medicine. So that's when I wrote the Skipper's Medical Emergency Handbook. And I guess that's kind of where it all started, really. So I wrote that with another doctor called Campbell McKenzie, who did the 92-93 Global Challenge. And I have to say, it was a bit like writing a book with your dad, and because he's a good bit older than me, and he's a Scottish chap, very Scottish. And there's one point where we're having some massive argument about some esoteric detail. He said, Spike, this is a bit like writing a book with your son. And I kind of thought, yeah, that's probably pretty true. But it just turned out to be, the book took about 2 years to write. And so that kind of came out, and that gained a lot of popularity in the industry as an alternative to the Ship Captain's Medical Guide, really. And then the company was getting busier and busier. And then 2011, we decided that we couldn't really continue on the kitchen table. So we moved, we got an industrial unit in Southampton, and then started from there, really. And now the original industrial units, we've now got three industrial units in Southampton, because it's just getting busier. We have an office in Palmer, and we have an office in Fort Lauderdale as well. So Nick runs the office in Palmer, and then Becky runs the office in Fort Lauderdale. And they do a fantastic job. I couldn't work with better people. They're unbelievably committed, and I honestly do think that I'm not just saying this. I honestly do think they do a very, very good job. So that's and amongst all that, I continued my medical training and eventually qualified as a consultant in 2005. So I've just completed 15 years as a consultant now. That's about it, really. Oh, and then of course, the MCA came to, so in 2017, the MCA came to me to see if I would take part in writing the new Ship Captain's Medical Guide. And it turned out that I was going to be the lead author. So I had two very, very good co-authors as well. And so the Ship Captain Medical Guide is somewhat based on the Skipper's Medical Emergency Handbook, in that it uses a very kind of algorithmic approach to medicine. So, and making use of red flags. So, you know, if you like looking somebody with headaches, you know, just how bad they are, and you know, if they're relieved by paracetamol or ibuprofen, and if they're not and if they're getting worse, you know, then that's a kind of like a red flag, and it can mean a variety of things. But at least it means that you, so the whole point about this book is that it gives you a framework within which to think, and it keeps you thinking, and it's set out in a fairly, I hesitate to say basic way, but it's set out in a very kind of clear way that people at sea who've done some kind of medical training, what we term as kind of advanced first aid training, that they can understand. So it gives them a nice framework, and keeps them thinking and keeps them doing things, because particularly in the first, you know, 20 or 30 minutes, when something catastrophic has happened, it's very easy to freeze. If you're not used to seeing that type of thing, very easy to freeze and then just, you know, not do anything. And so hopefully that it's the book's kind of aimed at doing that. So it's set out in a very specific kind of way, very consistent way across all kinds of disease processes. It also incorporates, so looking back over the past, you know, 25 years that I've been involved in doing this type of thing, like I said, there are three things which have changed fundamentally in remote medicine, because that's effectively what we do. It's not just marine medicine, it's remote medicine. We roll this out for, you know, mostly, well, for a lot of super yachts, racing yachts, but a lot of commercial shipping these days, security companies, aircraft, and also on land stuff as well in remote places in the world. So it's very much the same way of thinking, the same way of setting things up. There's three things kind of changed things during that time. First of all, as we all know, global communications have changed, you know, hugely. And even from when I was going around the world, which was, you know, 96, 97, it was SSB radio from the Southern Ocean through Portishead and, you know, da da, and it was a bit kind of hit and miss sometimes. Now we get calls from, you know, down on the Antarctic Peninsula. Somebody just picks up the telephone, or the Northwest Passage, Northeast Passage, you know, middle of the North Kiribati, you know, all over the world. And they just pick up a telephone and they just call, which is fantastic, because we can then tell them what to do. So all our training courses are built on, you know, teaching practical skills, because if we teach the practical skills, then, yeah, we can tell them to do something. Then they can do the, you know, resetting a fracture or suturing up skin or, you know, whatever it might be. So global communications has just transformed things, and just made a big. That's not a gunshot. That I've got a fire going here in the lounge. So that was a piece of wood just kind of exploding. The second thing is what we call point of care testing. So, and we use this in intensive care all the time. So point of care testing means probably the most obvious thing, particularly after a year of COVID, is a pulse oximeter. So this is a little device which you stick on the end of your finger, and it tells you in a few seconds how much oxygen is in your blood and also your heart rate as well. And that's just fantastic. Actually, the technology inside a pulse oximeter is phenomenally complex, but it's so easy to use. You just stick it on your finger and it works. And if you go back, 35 years in medicine, in theatres, they would have one pulse oximeter between two theatres, unbelievably. So you'd be having an operation and there wouldn't be a pulse oximeter there, just measuring something which is entirely basic. So the point of care testing, whether that's pulse oximeters or glucose meters devices now measuring all kinds of things in blood just very, very easily, or ultrasound is another very useful thing. So the onset of point of care testing has transformed remote medicine amazingly. And the third thing is, it's actually the mainstay of the Ship Captain Medical guide, which is using the algorithms in medicine. So making managing medical conditions or trauma conditions offshore so much easier, and giving people a clear pathway in which to think. And all these algorithms, I mean, I've invented them all, but they're actually based on the original algorithms, which started just as I started medicine, the ALS or ACLS, as it used to be called, and ATLS things came out, and they were all based on algorithms. And so that's what stimulated me in the mid 2000s to apply that across, you know, a massive amount of other parts of medicine. And so I owe a lot of debt of gratitude to to the people who originally came up with the algorithms for the ACLS and ATLS programs. So those three things I think have transformed medicine and just enables us to, you know, deliver much better healthcare to people working offshore of all shapes and sizes, in all kinds of parts of the industry, whether it's oil and gas or wind farms or super yachts or racing yachts or, you know, commercial shipping or security companies or, you know, whatever it might be, or environmental companies. So we support some environmental companies as well, who are going around doing environmental research in different places in the world. So it's really quite just integrating all those things. So integrating the medical kit supply, and then teaching people how to use the toolbox that they have, the medical toolbox that they have on board, and then providing them with a telemed service which knows what they have on board and of what they are capable. And if we do that, then we can deliver pretty good quality healthcare. So that's about it, really.
That's the
entire contents of my head.
Yeah, as I like to say, you know, when we're training you guys, you know, we're trying to give you the skills to be the eyes and ears of the doctor. So if you know how to use everything in the kit and all these technology that Spike's talking about, then it makes, you know, the doctor's job so easy. You're there, you know, and you know how to use it. So it saves so much time. And one thing I'd like to add is you came up with you've also put all that top technology together and invented a telemedicine unit as well. Yeah, so that's what's your thoughts on telemedicine and the future of telemedicine?
Well, I think certainly bandwidth it's all down to bandwidth, really. In my sat, I've just been putting up some new satellites which are going to increase bandwidth, particularly in the high latitudes. So that's up towards the North Pole and down towards the South Pole. So that's going to make a considerable difference to communications. And so we've put together a telemedical communication platform called Themis. Actually, Themis is named Themis for a very good reason, because Themis was the Greek goddess of law and order. And I'm married to a lawyer, so in a way, this is named after my wife. So she's very happy about that. So Themis, but basically, it does bring kind of order to a process of assessing a patient offshore. So it's a way of bringing all these things together. So communication and point of care testing and the way of thinking all in kind of one package. We've used it quite a few times and to very good effect. And it makes a big difference to us when you see. So there's another concept which I was going to mention, and that's about the evidence, or the, as Amanda, you just kind of referred to, and that's the format that the evidence about somebody's medical condition comes to us from offshore. So the subject, what we split into two bits, the subjective evidence and objective evidence. So subjective evidence is basically that's what it is. It's subjective. So it's somebody's opinion about whether somebody looks unwell or doesn't look unwell, or whether somebody says that they feel breathless or not, or, you know, and pain can be quite subjective as well. And there's no kind of way of measuring it. It's just like a a fairly loose or kind of imprecise in a way, but subject to interpretation, somebody's opinion about it. So that's subjective evidence. Objective evidence is essentially numbers. So that's somebody's blood pressure or their pulse rate or the oxygen saturation or a blood gas or a ketone level or something called a hematocrit or peak flows or something like that. But it's a number. Now, a number in itself is valuable. But the great thing about numbers is you can plot trends. And so when you're looking at something, you can then start to see whether they're getting worse or whether they're getting better, particularly associated with whatever treatments you might be giving them. And so actually having objective evidence and then being able to plot trends with that is phenomenally important. And it's exactly what we do on intensive care. That's what we do. There's jokes about intensivists that we don't look at patients, we just look at numbers. I mean, of course, we look at patients as well, but the numbers are actually rather important in assessing patients. And particularly when me as a doctor sitting here on the other telephone, when I don't actually have hands on the patient, then it's, getting numbers through is important. The other thing, of course, is voice communications and video communications as well. So we use video quite a lot. What we do use a lot of is images, so photographs, and we use a lot of photographs, and they are very useful at comparing one bent limb with another limb that's not bent, or somebody's if they've broken a thumb, or You look at one hand, you look at the other hand, and you've got something kind of objective to compare it against. I remember, I think it was 2012 on the Volvo Ocean Race. Having a boat going down towards the Cape Verde Islands, and somebody with a swollen leg, and I remember the team sent me a very nice photograph, but just of one leg. So I couldn't tell whether this guy just had a fat leg or not. But when they sent me, so I asked them to send me a photograph of both legs next to each other, so I had something to compare it against. And actually, he had a very swollen leg, and so there was no question that he was going to need to be evacuated. Actually, the team did a very good job, set everything up, and then slowed down just off the Cape Verde Islands, dropped the guy off, and then got down and won the leg down to Cape Town. So they won the leg, and they did the medical evacuation as well on the way. So that's,
won the leg and saved a leg.
Right?
Oh, won the leg and saved a leg.
Yeah, well, he won the leg and saved. Yeah, it's very good actually. Yeah, very good indeed. And the guy was back on the boat in Cape Town. Having had a course of IV antibiotics, intravenous antibiotics and what have you. So all round, very good care.
Yeah. Actually, now you've mentioned the Volvo race too, I'd just like to point out to the viewers that you've been a medical advisor for the Volvo or the Ocean Race for quite a few years. Yep. The America's Cup, now. The Golden Globe, the ARC Around the World race. You seem to look after a lot of these guys.
Yeah, so not the ARC, but the Oyster World Rally. So we've been medical advisors for them for the past, and they're just coming up to their third version now. So we've done the previous two. I've been the chief medical advisor for the Volvo for over 12 years now or so, and the Golden Globe and various other races as well. And we support some of the boats in the Vendée as well. So they're all coming back up the Atlantic now, more or less all still in one piece. So I'm touching wood as I say that. So it's good, and we've got a very eclectic bunch of clients, from families sailing around the world there's one family sailing around the world that we have medical support for. They got five children on board from the age of, the youngest one was two when they started, they're now three, and the oldest one's about 14. So but five kids, and they got boats about 46 foot, so they're chugging around. So we get calls from them occasionally. And so they're homeschooling or yacht schooling. And so it's obviously everybody's nowadays. So or homeschooling anyway.
Yeah, so. Actually, speaking of homeschooling, that brings me to my next topic is COVID. How's COVID impacted your world? And what are your thoughts on, boats having testing kits, and how do you think the vaccine will impact the industry?
Well, so that's so the whole year has really been about COVID, and slightly ironically, last 1st of January 2020, my New Year's resolution was that I wasn't going to fly as much as I had done the previous year, because I did about 50 flights the previous year. And I thought, you know, this just isn't good. So it was slightly ironic that that was my my New Year's resolution. So this year, so last year in 2020, I did a total of 4 flights. So that was it. And I've done a lot more miles on my bike, and I'm a lot fitter for it. I'm a lot fitter for it. You know, our business has done reasonably okay. We haven't grown. We've still grown, but not as much as we thought we were going to do. But we are, in the greater scheme of things, we're in a good place. We have nothing to complain about at all. We're okay. And it's been very, so it's been very, very good just to, you know, help a lot of super yacht captains and chiefs and what have you get through the year with very, very difficult circumstances. And at the moment, I have to say, the situation is somewhat worse than it's been at any point so far. So we've got, and this morning I've been dealing with another COVID kind of problems, or two COVID problems on the yachts in the Caribbean. It's very, very hard. It's very hard for the captains and it's very hard for the crew. And the boats are continuing to try and work as well, of course. So with testing, obviously, PCR testing remains the gold standard without doubt, and it's not 100% by any means, because one of the biggest problems is actually taking good quality swabs. So we've all had nasal swabs done, and I have to say, I mean, I don't like it, and you know, but I've had quite a few tests done by people, and I don't particularly like it, but you've got to get a good quality swab if the test is going to reveal a true result. So that's one of the major sticking points, both with PCR testing and with lateral flow testing, and they're the two main forms of testing. So PCR testing, obviously gold standard. The lateral flow testing, I mean, we started supplying those in November, but with all the net proceeds going to charity, so we've raised over £60,000 now for charity from that. So, and we've been selling them pretty cheaply as well, so that's been pretty good, really. Now, so the lateral flow tests are I don't think there's much difference between which one you get, I don't think. Although there's lots of different types out there now. So you have to be, so getting it from a known reputable company is probably the best thing that you can do. So getting it from a small unknown company probably isn't the right thing to do, because their quality control may just not be there. The other thing about lateral flow tests is that they quote very, very good performance figures for them. But those performance figures are from tests usually carried out in laboratories, or they don't really represent real life kind of exercise of the test. And also they are being used for detecting high viral loads. So you've got a lot of virus in you. And if you've got a lot of virus in you, they are very good at spotting that and spotting if you haven't got a high viral load. They are much less good at spotting people with low viral loads who are either getting better or getting worse. So in the UK, there was a big mass testing program in Liverpool. So that was real life on the ground, real life comparison of how the tests work. And they weren't that good. They weren't that good. So a lot of false positives and a lot of false negatives. So, but particularly false negatives. So I think if you're using lateral flows, so lateral flows are useful from the point of view of doing repeated testing. So like testing everybody every week, or testing everybody on some boats every day, or testing somebody who starts to become symptomatic and testing them every, you know, every 12 or 24 hours over the first couple of days, just to see if they suddenly become positive, whilst taking precautions as well. So I think if anybody starts to show symptoms, I think you're wise, particularly in a confined environment or a close environment on a yacht, you're wise to think that they are presumed that they are COVID positive until proven negative. and you can do repeat lateral flow testing. And that's one of the strengths of the lateral flow testing. If you do it repeatedly, which obviously much more difficult to do with PCR testing, much easier to do with lateral flow testing, then your accuracy is going to be improved. And I think that's a generally held correct opinion in the scientific community. The other thing, of course, is the person who's taking the test, apart from wearing, you know, protective equipment so they don't become infected whilst taking the test, because obviously you're very close to somebody, is just watching the training videos or getting hands-on training from somebody who knows how to do nasal swabs, because watching the training videos, some of the training videos are pretty good. But if you don't take a good swab, you're not going to get an accurate result. So that's actually rather important. And I suspect that people who never knew anything about nasal swabbing now will be coming, by the time you've done it 10 times, you know, hopefully you're much more of a, you know, much more of an expert at it. But I can't emphasize that enough. So lateral flow, repeat testing, and good quality swabs. So that's lateral flow testing, and that's for the antigen. So that's testing for part of the virus. Now, we all know about antibody testing, and there's absolutely no reason. There was never any reason for anybody to be doing antibody testing. And I know when all this started, a lot of companies put a lot of antibody testing kits out there, and they were not particularly accurate, and B, it tells you your body's response to something that happened 3 weeks previously. But for yacht captains, they need to know the person in front of them, are they infectious or not? And an antibody test absolutely doesn't tell you that at all. There's mm-hmm. no point in doing antibody testing at all. Yeah. So if you're going to get lateral flow testing, just get them from a reputable company. That's probably the best thing you can do, and take and do them repeatedly, good nasal swabs. But still, despite all this, PCR testing remains the best outcome. So,
and vaccines, what are your thoughts on the vaccines?
Well, so vaccines are on our way out of this, but it's going to take, so one of the most sensible comments I've heard over the past year about all this was actually from the head of Pfizer. So just after the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine was announced at the end of November, and after all the initial kind of, you know, everybody thinking that everything was going to be solved by Christmas, he came on the radio and actually said he thought that with all the vaccines, we may be back to a normal-ish kind of life by next Christmas. So most of this year is going to be spent taking a good deal of precautions about the virus. Now, the rollout of the vaccine across is patchy across the world. In first world countries making progress. Second and third world countries, obviously their access to the vaccine is much more limited. So if you're going to places like that, you're more at risk. You're more at risk. Which type of vaccine? So I've just been vaccinated actually during the past week. So I had the Pfizer, I was given the Pfizer vaccine. I didn't really have much of a choice about what I was going to get. I was just given it, which is fine. I don't know whether I've got antibodies, but all my household have all had COVID about two and a half weeks ago, whereas my PCR test was negative. So, but now I've had the vaccine as well. But the vaccines take about 3 weeks for the first shot to become reasonably kind of effective. And of course you do a second shot, but the governments are tending to roll out all first shots first injections, and then we'll come along and catch up with the second injection. And there's we've got a lot to learn about these vaccines, because they've been developed very quickly. And so we have, you know, I think the safety data is pretty good. So I've not had any kind of hesitation about having a vaccine myself. I think that's a very important to stress. So the main thing we're going to need to learn is how effective it is in different types of people. So people with different medical histories and on different medications and things like that. So that's something that we're going to learn about during the next year. So I don't think it matters which vaccine you have. What I would say is that this is obviously because we're getting a lot of questions from the yachting community about getting vaccines. Vaccines, as far as I know, are not privately available. So because the governments have bought up all the vaccine stocks. So it's very difficult for yacht crew because they probably have to go back to their country of residence to get the vaccine, which means travel. And this is not just yacht crew. This is all commercial seamen out there, commercial mariners out there as well. So it's not only of, all the yacht crew and particularly the commercial sailors, commercial mariners have had a hard time during the past year. It's not going to end too quickly for them because there's no plan in place on how to address this. Mm. And that is a big problem. That is a big problem because governments are like looking after their own populations, not anybody else's population. And you kind of can't blame them for doing that, but it does leave anybody who's in another country or working in a different country, it leaves them at a disadvantage. What I would say is that as people get more vaccines, the general risk for the world community will go down. So I mean, one of the biggest risks for particularly for super yacht crew is the amount of people coming in and off the boat. Now, if they're all being vaccinated, there'll be less chance of them actually bringing COVID onto the boat. So that is, part of the light at the end of the tunnel. But the tunnel is fairly long, I'm afraid to say.
Yeah.
So, and I don't have a good, easy answer for that. But so if anything changes, I will let you know.
Thank you. Well, there's so many questions I could ask. I'm going to have to get you on the show again because there's lots of your personal adventures and gory stories that I'd like to catch up on and share with the viewers. But we'll save that for another time. Thanks so much, Dr. Spike, for coming on the show. It's been really good to have you here.
Okay, no worries at all. Thanks, Amanda. Keep well.
Thanks very much, everyone. You're listening to Yachting International Radio with Amanda, and I've been interviewing Dr. Sprite Briggs from Medical Support Offshore. See you next Monday.